Today on Doomed! What really happened to Michael Reinhold? An anti-fascist who allegedly gunned down a member of a far-right group and was shot and killed by police after a manhunt that was pretty much being cheerled by the now former president, Donald Trump. We'll be getting into all the background of this entire case and the latest revelations that have just come out just a few weeks ago that really get to the bottom of what happened when the police and Michael Reinhold met, I guess you can say. And to join me now, let me pull us all up on the feed. Joining me now to discuss this case is journalists Ryan Haas and Conrad Wilson with the Oregon Public Broadcasting. With Oregon Public Broadcasting, excuse me. I said the Oregon Public Broadcasting as if it was like the public, like PBS, like the public broadcasting system. No, that's not it. Thanks for joining me, guys.
Yeah. Hey, Matt. Thanks for having us. Good to be here.
Really appreciate you both coming on because you both have covered this story extensively. I mean, I've been actually sort of really enthralled by this whole thing. I mean, this really is like almost straight out of a movie, this whole thing, just how it all went down. And, you know, from the day I first heard about Michael Reinhold's confrontation with that member of that right wing group, which we'll get more into very shortly, to when the, Trump got involved, to the police looking for him, and then finally how it all came to an end. And then even then it didn't end with how police claim it all went down and what you guys will tell everyone here that we just found out recently. I mean, this whole thing is just bonkers.
Yeah, it really is in a lot of ways. I was before our conversation today, I was just reading back over some of the coverage that we did, and it was like, wow, there's a lot of strange details to this story. So
and it took a lot of twists and turns.
And you two have been, I mean, this happened in Portland. So when police found him, that where was he then? Was he still in the, he was no longer in Oregon, right?
No, he was in Lacey, Washington, which is near Olympia, so south of Seattle, basically.
Okay. So, you know, but you two have been covering this from the very beginning. And well, first of all, I want to say thank God for local reporting and the work you guys do, because really, I don't think I've seen any outlets. I mean, you know, there's been national outlets that did a good job, but no one has been on this. And then this latest revelation stuff, like I saw from you two at OPB. So thank you for keeping on this.
Well, thanks for reading. Yeah, it's great to talk about it.
Now, before we jump into Michael Reinhold's story and what happened to him, I think we should start with the very beginning. And I think that beginning is with the right-wing group that the person he shot. I mean, are we, you know, it hasn't, I mean, I guess we'll never really know because he'll never face his day in court, but it's pretty established that Michael Reinhold shot Aaron J. What was his last name again?
Danielson.
I mean, I said allegedly at the beginning of the show, but I mean, I think it's pretty clear what happened from the video.
Yeah, I mean, the shooting came at, it happened in downtown Portland. It was August 29th. And, you know, it came at the end of a long summer for Portland. You know, following the death of George Floyd, like many cities across the country, there were just huge protests. And it was, those protests were, there were a lot of families, there were a lot of, you know, activists, community members that, you know, and just like thousands of people taking to the streets. And later in June, those started to die down. In July, there was, some real federal intervention, kind of putting Portland on the map in a big way, the way the Trump administration responded to some of the racial justice protests. And then in August, you know, things kind of turned again, and you sort of had right-wing groups and, interacting with kind of Black Lives Matter protesters. And so this kind of came, I guess, if you could think about it, in three acts almost, this was sort of the end of the the third act, you know, of this just bizarre, you know, very intense, emotional summer, you know, for Portland.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, as Conrad said, you know, when federal officers were here in Portland and there was thousands upon thousands of people on the street, you didn't really see a lot of right wing presence. It was kind of like people squaring off with federal agents. But after those federal agents left and, you know, we were getting towards election season and President Trump at the time was campaigning on this message of law and order and, you know, calling Portland an anarchist jurisdiction and stuff, you started to see right-wing groups again come into the city as they have for years to really square off with anti-fascists and basically anybody they saw as being sort of antithetical to the president's message of law and order. And that's kind of how we got this rally. There was this big truck rally that was supposed to be, you know, celebrating the president. So all these big trucks with, you know, Trump flags were sort of supposed to go down the freeway, not come downtown. And
it was like miles too. I mean, this is like a convoy, you know, a caravan of just, you know, trucks and cars and flags with Trump. And I mean, it was really, really, really long.
Now, Aaron J. Danielson is with a specific group, Patriot Prayer. And I've talked about them on this show before, but they seem to be like, I guess they didn't go as nationals like the Proud Boys did, but they were from the very early Trump years. I remember seeing, I remember that first year of his term. 2017, I feel like Patriot Prayer was constantly in the news, at least if you track, you know, right-wing rallies and events that were going on across the country. They were constantly having events end in violence in Portland, it seemed.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, this group really formed around the time when the free speech protests were kind of happening in Berkeley and people were squaring off with anti-fascists there. And they were formed in a town just across the river from Portland. And so they would a more conservative place, Vancouver, Washington, and they would regularly come into the city for years and years and sort of get into fistfights and, you know, these extended conflicts that would happen with very little police intervention. So in some ways, it was like the night Aaron Danielson was killed was like a lot of nights of protests that had happened in Portland. But it took place following this really sort of heated summer and where tensions were just very palpable ahead of the election. Jay Danielson and the leader of that group of Patriot Prayer, Joey Gibson, you know, they had been hanging out all day. They were drinking. Danielson, when he died, you know, had alcohol in his blood. And so when this caravan got stopped in downtown Portland, there was just tons of conflicts happening. And it, you know, in some ways, it's almost not surprising that the violence happened.
Right. Now, I remember watching that day go down. It was like August 29th, right, of last year.
Right.
And I remember seeing so many clips of it. I've seen truck rallies before. I've seen confrontations before. But I don't think I've ever seen something so brazen where it seemed like this group, this right-wing group, was it all Patriot Prayer, by the way, or was this like a culmination of
it was a political rally, really, for the president. I mean, it was people who wanted to, and there were a number of these, you know, in different cities around the country, I believe, where you'd have these kind of big truck rallies, and it was really just like a campaign event. This particular one, it came from kind of a suburb of Portland. There was a kind of a mall several miles away, and folks got on the highway, and it got routed into downtown Portland. And you had kind of these scenes that played out where there was tension between, supporters of the president, members of Patriot Prayer, just other people. And there were it was not the most violence we've seen all summer, but there were clashes between you know, folks in pickups and protesters calling names and, you know,
well, some of the folks, you know, some of the folks in the trucks had paintball guns and then yeah. people in the crowd right. that's, were throwing
that's what I was getting at when I was even when I said how it was something more brazen than I've usually seen. It seemed like they were just indiscriminately hitting people who were just in walking down the street, not even necessarily anti-fascist counter protesters. It just seemed like they were literally driving by and shooting people with paintball and bear, you know, paintballs and bear mace. And even that was a little bit like, you know, if this is a rally for your guy, the president, why would you be, one thing to clash with counter protesters, another thing to just be shooting passerbys on the street with mace and paintballs.
It was provocative for sure.
Now that all happens, that all goes down, and somehow we end up with Gibson and Danielson walking down the street. Do we know where they were going? Were they going somewhere else? Or were they ending the night? Or
it was actually so Daniels. I don't know where Gibson actually went. So this rally happens, and I think actually I do know because I just talked to Gibson recently. His vehicle was in the front of this caravan, and Danielson and a guy named Chandler Pappas were in a different vehicle more towards the back, I believe. And Danielson actually lived in Portland, which is the crazy thing. So they were walking Danielson and Pappas were walking down the street. And surveillance video from that night shows them kind of come around a corner. Michael Reinell just happens to be walking down this street and sees them. It appears in the video anyway. It's kind of like car park surveillance video. So as best as you can make out, but it appears like Reinell sees them and ducks into a parking garage. And Danielson and Pappas cross the street, and then Reinell comes back out, and then you have this confrontation, which happens. And it's not entirely clear. Actually, Conrad, I believe you had seen in some of your reporting, you had seen a video of them at a protest before this, where they
the day before there was a rally in just across the Columbia River in Washington State, and kind of a suburb outside of Portland called Camas, Washington. I think it was in Camas. And there was Jay Danielson was there, and so was Michael Reinell. It was a much, much smaller kind of a protest or rally, but it was kind of a flag wave, is what Patriot Prayer would call them. You know, they'd wave the flag, and you'd see, you know, Trump flags, American flags, Thin Blue Line flags. And Michael Reinell's there talking to people and kind of, it was, it's a video. And actually the live stream is of, I think it's Joey Gibson's like GoPro mm-hmm. from the day. There was nothing that showed them actually interacting, but they were kind of in a pretty small place the day before this happened.
Wow.
Go ahead, Matt.
No, I also just discovered that this for the past like almost a year now, I've been saying Michael Reinell's name wrong. That's okay. That's the problem, I guess, with working this past year. When you don't interact with anybody and just read everything and you don't know how to pronounce anything. do we know or did they ever divulge if there was ever any? I mean, interaction at all between it. I mean, I know you just said they were in a similar space, but we don't know if there ever was.
Yeah, we don't know. I mean, I talked to Chandler Pappas, and he didn't know. The night after the caravan went through, you know, the Trump caravan went through and had ended in downtown Portland, the night of the shooting. As Ryan had said, Jay and Chandler and had been drinking, and they were going to go check out the Justice Center, and then the federal courthouse is where a lot of the protests had gone on all summer long, and they were just a couple blocks away. And in talking to Chandler, they were basically headed over that way to just kind of see what was going on. It was still pretty early evening, and that's when you see this surveillance video, and it's just this. It really looks like a chance encounter, Chandler and Jay are kind of walking up one street, and they almost run in. They almost run into Reinel, and as Ryan said, you see him duck into the parking garage, and Pappas and Danielson walk by, and that's just seconds later, that's when there's this shooting.
Right. Now you had sent me a video, and I think I saw this, but I think most people have not seen this video. The one that was in that ProPublica piece that worked on, Conrad. I'm going to put it up. You won't be able to see it, but I'm just going to, while we talk, I just want people to sort of be able to see. Now, it seems like that Reinel realizes who's walking behind him. And then, like you said, he ducks into the parking garage. Now, again, so much of this we'll never know because of what happened to Reinel, and, the Patriot Prayer guys won't know, but... Do we know at all if Reinel, realized this in advance? Like, did he duck in the garage specifically because he saw who was there and intended on doing something? Or, was it just a chance that he went in the garage and they walked by and that's when he realized?
I mean, what we can say for sure is that Jay Danielson was wearing a Patriot Prayer hat at the time. They both, him and Chandler Pappas, both, I believe, were carrying bear mace. I think if I recall correctly in that video that's being shown, you can see Jay Danielson has a baton. One of them has a baton in their hand, I believe.
Yeah, I don't know if Chandler had any bear mace, but Jay definitely had some bear mace and kind of this expandable baton.
Yeah, and you see when Reinel comes out of the garage, he's reaching in his pocket, which it seems like that's where he was carrying this handgun at. And once they cross the street, in the video with the sound, or in a second video that OPB obtained with sound, you hear Reinel say, "Hey, we got one over here," or something of that accord. And then you see Danielson. We really had to slow this video down because this happens so fast. It's like a split second that this happens. But if you go frame by frame in that video, you see Danielson start to raise his bear mace, and then Reinel fires a single shot. The bear mace explodes, and then Reinel fires a second shot, and that's the one that hit Danielson.
And it all happens so fast.
Right. I remember when this happened, and I was doing a live stream show that night, and this came up, and I downloaded that original first video that was much harder to tell than the one that you were able to get your hands on, which, geez, this video is really close to what happened. And from that original video that I was looking at, I did the same you guys did, slowed it down, and because I was wondering who was the initial, person that engaged, because obviously, it seems like Reinel does call to them or makes his presence known because they're walking away from him, don't see him. That's when they turn around. Somebody, like you said, yells out about he's taking it out. He's got mace. It's unclear who says that, but Danielson does pull up mace first, and he does spray mace at Reinel first too. Now, obviously in the end it doesn't matter because we never know. I mean there'll be no day in court, but for a lot of people I think that would be a case where who knows what Danielson had in his hand. You might have to defend yourself.
It's very hard to say what Michael Reinel was thinking in that instance. After this shooting happened, there was this Vice interview where Michael Reinel gave an interview, and he spoke, and, Vice aired, a very short amount of that interview. They spoke for about an hour. OPB in our reporting, we were able to locate a second camera person who was there when that was shot and obtain the full, interview. And I think what's interesting is that, when you listen to that interview, Michael Reinel talks about how he, before the summer, wasn't really involved in social justice issues, wasn't really an activist, but he got really jazzed up on the social movement that was taking over the summer. And he just started going downtown and decided he was going to provide security for people of color at protests. And, my sense was Michael Reinel in some ways was, thought he was protecting people, I guess, is what I would say. You know, whether that's misguided or not, I can't really say, because, you know, we don't have the opportunity to interview him more after this incident happened.
Right. Well, and talking to, like, well, I mean, and, you know, we checked some of his social media stuff right after he, you know, after the shooting, his name started kind of to percolate out as kind of a person of interest law enforcement was looking at. And, you know, you looking at his like Instagram page, for example, I mean, it was like, you know, he was a dad, he was into hikes, he was into nature. And, you know, around, I don't know, if late June, early July, kind of as the protests in Portland were really, really heightened and kind of getting, you know, bigger and bigger, especially the response from the federal government. I mean, you just, you know, he, you know, the very famous quote, he's sitting about 100% Antifa. I mean, you right. know, he just got really, you kind of see in his, at least the way he's posting on social media, what appears to be a very quick change, right? From a, you know, a guy who's really into his dog and his kids and, you know, beautiful Oregon scenery, snowboarding, to kind of these images of protests and a lot of political, you know, commentary that, you know, going back years, you didn't really see.
Right. Now, I remember at the time, a story came out about how just a few days, maybe it was, but some very small amount of time before this all went down, he'd actually got arrested. You know, he got pulled over with his son in the car or something, got arrested, and they found a firearm, which I guess ends up being the gun that he uses here. What happened there? Why was he pulled over, and why did they let him? You know, if they arrested him because of the gun, why did they let him back out with the gun?
So I think there's a couple different instances there. Actually, one was with his son, and one. So he was in Eastern Oregon, and he was basically like drag racing with his son, it seems, based on the police reports. So he was just like going, I think over 100 miles an hour. They were going really fast, kind of in this really remote part of Oregon. And they got pulled over. His son was in one car. His teenage son was in one car, and his daughter, who's like middle school age, was in Rynell's car with a dog. I think there was a cat. They found some, I think they found a, you know, cannabis, and I honestly do not remember if they found a weapon or not. I mean, you feel free to, not in that one. Did they not?
I don't remember in that one.
I don't remember.
The second arrest was the second.
Yeah, but in the second arrest, for sure. Like, he's at a, this is in July. This is and he was arrested during a confrontation with police, basically. You know, I mean, he kind of like, I think he was arrested for assaulting an officer. I believe that was the charge. But he was booked, he was arrested, you know, there's documentation, and he was released.
Right.
And I'm not sure it was the same gun, because Conrad, and correct me if I'm wrong, didn't he obtain the gun that was used in the killing after that arrest?
Yeah, I think he did. And it, there's some stuff in the court documents that, you know, that were used to justify the murder charge that, you know, Rynell was charged with murder by the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. And there's some text exchange in there between Rynell and his son. And basically, Rynell's asking his son for a gun. He's saying, you know, I need a gun. I need it now.
Now, so you brought up the Vice interview. That's sort of, I guess, where this ends up. He comes out. The next part of this story is he comes out, does this interview with Vice. And you know, what do we know? What I guess he wanted to sort of try to control the narrative. Like, do we know how that went down? Like, how did he get in touch? Because at the time, I remember, had Trump already started getting involved at this point? Because there was like a big manhunt for him, in terms of like at least what you saw online with you know, Trump supporters sort of looking. They were out for this guy. The video was going viral everywhere.
Well, and there was a lot of court documents too. I mean, that, you know, in court documents that were released months later, it was clear like police were getting tips really early, that, you know, they suspected that this was Rynell, or, you know, faces. And I mean, it was coming together far faster than I, you know, realized even at the time.
If I remember correctly, his name and face were, I saw those starting to percolate on 4chan, like, almost instantly, and then it quickly moved from there to Twitter, and then it was, you know, I saw on Twitter, like, people saying his name, like, why don't they arrest this guy, blah, blah, blah. I mean, within 24 hours of this happening.
Right. And a lot of those tips had gone to law enforcement mm-hmm. saying, oh, you know, we're getting a bunch of names, you know, people are identifying them on social media sites. He, after the shooting, he fled. We interviewed his son, and his son said that he had, you know, people helping him, basically trying to move around, you know, and he had no intention of turning himself in, according to his son. He was just trying to kind of lay low and move from, you know, houses to hotel rooms and that kind of thing. And that's he ended up.
Did he ever tell his son, or maybe the better question is, did his son ever say that anything that he told him in terms of his you know, his recollection of what went down with Danielson, or he didn't really talk about that?
His son didn't say a whole lot about it. Racking my brain. He did know that something had happened. You know, he also felt like his dad was in danger, that, you know, right-wing groups were basically trying to come after him. The night of the shooting, actually, Reinel's son said that he was home with his sister, and, you know, they heard some trucks drive by, and they actually heard, gunfire and a couple of the bullets, according to his son, hit the house. When we were there talking to him, you know, we kind of looked at the siding, and you can see, you know, some spots that looked like they would have been hit by gunfire.
Well, you're talking about like his house, like the one he wasn't in, like his actual, the place he lived and was no longer at.
Yeah. Yep. Right. Wow. But his kids were there. Yeah.
Right. Wow. Geez. And he had young children too, right?
His son, I believe, is 17 or 18, and then the daughter, I believe, was in middle school, so much younger.
Right, right. Now, so he does the interview with Vice, and when he did the interview with Vice, was he already out of the state? Do we know that, or was he still in?
No, he was still in Oregon when that happened. You know, I don't know what compelled him to do that interview. You know, I feel like what he says in that interview, he says, you know, I was trying to protect a person of color, and that's why I did this. You know, later the person who he said he was trying to protect would later say, I don't even know who this guy was. Like, I was just walking down the street and he happened to be close to me. You know, I don't know the truth of any of that, but you know, I mean, I'm sure Michael knew that his name was out there, right? Like, we as journalists knew it was out there. It was very out there very quickly. I'm sure he knew his name was out there.
Well, within hours of the shooting, right? I mean, with hours of, you know, of the shooting in downtown Portland, I mean, people are driving by his house, you know, shooting at it.
Right.
Mean, yeah. Right. His name was out there.
He knew from his son people had like possibly driven by and fired on the house. So, you know, perhaps he just felt like I have to get my side of the story out there. I don't know.
Right. It was very weird. Like, I can't recall anything like that before. Like, obviously, there's probably been cases where someone, you know, calls up a reporter and tells them a little something. But to like in the middle of being on the run to take the time out to do a full blown like video shoot with a reporter and, you know, take the time to do the video with your, you know, tell your side of the story. You know, it was just really bizarre, I thought. It does feel like it was an opportunity for him to control the narrative, and I think it sort of might have not, you know, gone the other way in terms of it just made the right more angry to find him, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I think is clear when you look at the full video, the full hour, is, for, you know, however you feel about this case, I think Michael right now was worried about his kids, and he was worried that he was going to go to jail at the very least for a long time. And, you know, you can hear the emotion in his voice in the video, which didn't air in the Vice in the Vice video, if I remember. But, you know, he says, like, I'm worried about my kids. I don't want them to be alone. I don't want them to be hurt, you know, et cetera. So perhaps he just wanted to get something out there. You could tell he was definitely worried about his children at the very least.
Right. So now let's go to, I guess, the when police find him. I mean, before we do that, you know, Trump, we should spend a second on Trump here, because he was really, you know, stoking the flames here. Like, you know, obviously, Ryan Hall had just allegedly killed somebody. And obviously, he would have had to face whatever consequences they were after going through the justice system here. Trump really seemed adamant early on in his tweets, and his tweets especially, I think, were cited as sort of like, even like, you guys can correct me, but I remember reading that like law enforcement were like being influenced by seeing his tweets in terms of like the levity of the situation of finding this guy. He was really involving himself, and to the point where he was calling for just straight up retribution, not even apprehension of the guy.
Yeah, I went back today and dug up some of the comments that he made. And, you know, in one of the articles Conrad wrote, he wrote, an hour before Rinell died, the president called on Portland police to arrest the, quote, cold-blooded killer of Jay Danielson. Quote, do your job and do it fast, he tweeted. So, I mean, stuff like that. And yeah, I mean, he said, you know, this is, we need retribution for what happened. And, you know, just very strange things to be saying in an active murder investigation, I guess, is what I would say.
And something that in talking to, like, you know, law enforcement that were actually involved and just trying to control the situation, I mean, this was not helpful at all. You know, I mean,
he was knocking the local police. Even he was saying how get it right, or we'll send someone in to do it. Right. I mean, continue what you were saying, Conrad. I'm sorry for interrupting.
Oh, no, it's all good. Yeah, I mean, it was just, I remember calling the Marshal Service for comment a couple of times, and they were just like, this is, you know, like their press office, you know, and they were just like, this is awful. Like, this is just a really difficult situation. We have nothing to say. Like, you know, I mean, it was you know, the law and order president was not helping law enforcement in those moments, you know?
Right, right. So let's get to what happens then. So I remember the news starting to come out and all the different stories. I mean, it was all over the place, the stories. And I think now from the latest revelations I read from you guys, it seems to have all sort of come out now. And I think it seems like an accurate portrayal of events from all the reporting you guys have done. You know, but at first, I remember the story was... and it was U.S. Marshals, wasn't it, who showed up? It wasn't even like actual Oregon or Washington police. It was feds.
Yeah, there was a and don't forget, like, this is the interview. I remember getting an email that the Vice put out like a press release, you know, that they had this interview, and they released like a couple of seconds, you know, and it's something like Rinell saying, you know, the shot was like the start of a civil war, or, you know, it was something very, like, one of the more kind of provocative things he said during this interview. And like, wow, this interview is going to air tonight. And, you know, there was so much, at least, you know, work from here. There was a lot of attention on what is he going to say? You know, what is this interview going to reveal? And it's kind of like all happening at the same time. And then, you know, suddenly the New York Times breaks the story that Rinell was killed. And I mean, it was within the sequence of a very, like, you know, like the attention surrounding this was heightened, I think, because of the Vice interview. And then, you know, he's shot and killed. I forget exactly what your question was, but it just,
he asked if it was U.S. Marshals, and it was actually a U.S. Marshals task force, which is like fugitive task force, which involves local police who are deputized and sort of like led by a U.S. Marshal. So there was, some county sheriff's deputies on this. There was a guy from a small town police department there. There was a corrections officer on this task force. So it was definitely a strange like amalgamation of law enforcement officers who were involved in this operation.
Right. Yeah. I mean, marshals do task forces a lot. These are like violent offender task forces. These would be like people that arrest fugitives or, you know, people that would escape from a jail or prison, you know, people that don't show up to court and they get a warrant issued for their arrest. Those are some of the types of things that task forces like these do.
Now, let me ask you this, because I was on the Majority Report with Sam Cedar earlier today, and I promoted that I was having you guys on, and this was the episode we were doing. And Sam had asked me to ask you guys. Now, I hadn't heard this. I don't know if he's confusing this with another case, but he had heard a rumor that Michael Reinhold possibly had a known or had a relationship with someone involved in the law enforcement, or was that something that you guys came across, or is that
that's news?
All right, that's news to me. I hadn't heard that. Yeah,
he must have been thinking of something else because I didn't recall ever hearing that. He wanted to know, and I had to ask. The police show up and he's in this. Where was he staying, by the way, in Washington? Was it a friend's house or something like that?
It was one of these. Oh, go ahead, Ryan.
Go ahead.
Oh, no. I mean, according to his son, he didn't know the guy. It was just kind of this network of, as his son described, like safe houses of people that were giving Reinhold a place to stay. And so this was one of those places. And that's why he ended up in Lacey, according to his son anyway.
Now, the police show up. The original story is like when the New York Times reported, like you said, you know, police found him, show up. There's some sort of shootout. I remember there were even interviews with witnesses who had said they had seen Reinhold with a gun out, returning gunfire, and it was some sort of like, you know, Wild West back and forth shootout. But then later on, it turns out we find out that doesn't seem to be the case.
Yeah, it was, it definitely was not the case. And the sheriff's office who investigated this, you know, very quickly came out with this story. We have witnesses who say Reinhold shot, our officers returned fire. Reinhold was killed. End of story. Boom, bang. That's what most people heard and moved on with. It was later, as you know, we continued to dig into this story, you know, Conrad went up there to Lacey, Washington, and talked to dozens of people who lived in the neighborhood. And they all seemed to tell the story of like, we didn't hear police commands. We saw unmarked vehicles pull up and people start shooting. And they were like, I don't know what happened, but it didn't seem like police. I thought it was just a shooting that was going on at first, you know? So
They thought it should be clear, it was several, not dozens, but they thought it was a couple of neighbors said, yeah, this isn't the best neighborhood. It's kind of like a bunch of apartments and these are sort of like townhouses. And they were just sort of saying it's not the best neighborhood. And they thought maybe it was like gang violence, basically, or, you know, like a drug deal or something that had gone wrong. And basically people were shooting each other. So it was just this cacophony of kind of guns, you know, and it was like a sunny evening, you know, there was a kid out riding his bike and, it was, you know, families were kind of around, like there's actually this one photo of, one of the bullets that, was part of the investigation and you see it going through a fence, through like a kiddie pool, like, you know, those little plastic kiddie pools. Of someone's backyard, through the wall of their apartment and into like this island and, you know, like a wall in their kitchen, you know, I mean, there was just a lot of, there were several stray bullets, there was a lot of firepower that was unleashed. It was something like 40 plus, 40-ish rounds, you know, and kind of, and just keep in mind, this is in seconds. This is just over a very short period of time.
They're lucky that there was somehow no one else got shot. Jeez.
Really?
40. Do we know how many actually hit Rhino?
I believe, if I remember right, there were 5 rounds that hit him. There were 3, and correct me if I'm wrong, Conrad, I believe there's 3 rounds recovered from his body, and then 2 rounds that they went through or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it was 5.
Yeah.
But some of those details evade me weeks and months later, but yeah.
And just to be completely clear here, he never even seemed to have even had his gun out, let alone shot back at them.
Right. I think one of the most interesting things that Conrad sort of found out was, you know, after this story of Rhinell shooting and, you know, Conrad finally gets his hand on the investigative file, and they say in the investigative file, we recovered a, you know, loaded 38 handgun from his front pants pocket. And it's sort of raised these questions of like, what does that mean? You said he shot the gun, and I believe at one point law enforcement said, well, maybe he shot and put the gun back in his pocket or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. You know, early on, like you said, that they kind of had two competing narratives. Well, there were two things that were competing with themselves, right? I mean, law enforcement said they had a witness, and they kind of came out saying in Washington State, there's these reporting rules about, you know, when officers use deadly force, you know, they report kind of findings as they go to the public. And so they put out this press release saying, yes, you know, we, what's the quote? I have it right here. You know, this is one of the investigators, you know, quote, we learned from a witness statement that Mr. Rhinell did display a weapon at the officers. And this is back in September, you know, in mid-September or so. And so at the same time in our reporting, we found out that they had recovered the gun inside Rhinell's pocket. And so, you know, with the shooting so early on there were questions, you know, in some of our earlier reporting, you know, how do you say he shot and at the same time recover a handgun in his pocket after he had died, with an event that had gone down really quickly. And even in the days before the full investigative file came out, you know, Thurston County investigators came out saying, I posed a question to one of the investigators. You know, they had announced they had completed their investigation, and they said something like, you know, I said, well, the way you're describing it, you know, like, did he fire a shot and then put it back in his pocket? And, you know, I mean, that doesn't make sense. And they said, well, it all happened really fast. You know, I mean, we don't, you know, and there's no body camera footage, you know, there's no surveillance video footage. And so there really isn't, it's sort of very, you know, your perspective is as good as anybody else's if you were there, you know. And as the, you know, the reporting has continued, it just seems, I don't know, it just seems really hard to see how he could have shot. You know, law enforcement says there's a chance, and they say that because they recovered a shell casing in the back seat of Rhinell's car. And there's no way to know if that was a shell casing from that event or, you know, a shell casing from months earlier. I mean, who knows, right?
Was he in his car? Because I had seen all sorts of, I even saw one report, I don't know if this is true, that he was like getting into his car, eating like gummy worms or something like that. I've seen all sorts of, do we know where he was in relation when the police come barreling down in their cars?
Yeah, there was definitely bad information that was put out early on. So someone who told
Rhinell was staying with,
who he was staying, basically the person he was staying with, told police at one point, oh, he was eating gummy worms and then these guys came up and shot him. Maybe I don't know if he was eating gummy worms or not, but he was in his car when police arrived, and gunfire starts. He gets out of his car, crawls basically, or starts moving towards the back of the car. There was a truck parked behind his car, I believe. Right. And then that is where he dies. So he was in his car while shooting starts. He gets out, starts moving, and then he's finally killed in the street there.
You know, and it's worth noting, like, there's no none of the officers in their written statements ever say they saw a gun. They do talk about not seeing his hands. They do talk about him trying to pull something out of his pocket when he's out of his vehicle. They see what they kind of describe as like the butt of a gun, but no one's ever, no one in their statement says basically they saw a weapon or a weapon was pointed at them. Further kind of raising questions about did he shoot or not?
Right. And now this latest piece from just last month that you have with these new documents that were released, there's honestly some things in here are so incredible to me. And this one specifically stuck out when I was reading it, and you can get into some of the other ones too. But this one, I honestly have been thinking about for the past like 4 weeks since when I first read this. Now, the police apparently came when they were coming down the road, and they knew he was there in his car, and they were coming at, or they knew he was there at the house or whatever, and they were coming at there. One of the cops apparently starts shooting inside his own car through his own windshield, and then the windshield shatters, which makes the cop who was in the who was next to him think he was being shot at.
That's right.
What? This is the most insane. I've never heard anything like that before. Have you guys ever come across anything like that?
No. It was reading the investigative reports, which these are just the officer reports themselves. This is not like some independent investigator. This is the officer statements. It was like reading an action movie or something. The officers see him. He's getting in his car. They're having all these radio problems. They can't talk to each other. And this officer, James Oliel, is in the passenger seat. And he says, we got to go now if we're going to get him, basically, is what he tells his partner, Officer Merrill, who's with him in the driver's seat. And so they, speed towards Rynell's car. And Merrill, in his report, says, like, I looked down to put the car in park and shards of glass started hitting me in the face. Oliel had, he kind of had his door ajar as they're coming up, and he starts shooting through the windshield. The front windshield of the car at Rynell several times, which is just, it's bizarre. I mean, I don't know what.
Yeah, I mean, you in reading it too, right, Ryan? Like, I mean, you definitely get the sense, like, so, one of the officers says an FBI agent has definitely told us they're trying to figure out if Rynell's actually in the apartment, right? Yeah. And, one of them says we got some intelligence from an FBI agent who says he's definitely in the apartment. And there's kind of this initial Marshall's team, and then there's a much bigger team that's kind of in the background in nearby streets, and these three vehicles are there, and you get the sense that people can't communicate, people aren't able to understand what's happening in kind of this critical moment, and Rynell comes out of his out of the place he's staying, he starts walking to his car, and in reading it, the commander on the scene that day was basically saying the plan was to, the plan was to arrest him as he was walking out of the apartment, like basically kind of do like a takedown, like a tackle or something, and try and arrest him that way before he ever got to the car. Well, he gets to the car and everyone's like, well, what are we going to do? And there's just this like heightened, a sense of, Ryan was saying, like, it reads like a thriller or something. I mean, they're very much so trying to figure out what to do. And that's when Officer Oliel, decides, like, we got to go if we're going to get him. And actually the commander on the scene said, let him drive away, basically, let him leave the scene. They can do a traffic stop or something later.
Yeah, he said, I didn't hear that on the radio. Our radios were bad or whatever. So, yeah.
It really is tragic kind of how it's like this miscommunication, seems to have at least played some part in how this went down.
Right, right. My opinion is that that honestly seems extremely suspect to me. Now, obviously, obviously, you've talked to them, and I'm sure, you know, like you said, the one of them wanted to wait for the traffic stop, which makes sense to me. But perhaps, you know, my complete.
We haven't talked to them. We'd love to talk.
Oh,
to them.
You didn't
just,
talk.
We've
to them.
Just
I'm sorry,
we've just read the
reports,
investigative
right.
file.
Right. I mean, my bad. Yeah. Now, do we know why? Where the miscommunication was between the witnesses original the telling of what the witnesses were first stating about it and what they actually said, where there was just, it was a one-sided thing. Like, where did that even, I mean, I know you said that the police put out this presser, but did they just make this up wholeheartedly, or did they,
well,
you know?
So they, you know, witnesses did tell them this, right? Like, there are witness statements where they say, like, the officers were taking fire. I've kind of like thought about this a lot, Matt, and like, how do you square this? And I think, you know, and this is 100% speculation, but it just seems like if Oliel was shooting out of his own windshield, like if you're just an eyewitness to this and you see bullet holes going into this windshield, right, you may not understand where those bullets are coming from, perhaps. I mean, that's the only possible explanation I can think of why an eyewitness would say, like, oh, Rynell was shooting.
Right. And we wouldn't know that until just recently when you guys uncovered this just literally last month. Like, this was previously unknown about the windshield. The windshield.
Yeah, I mean, we don't like, it's hard to speculate, right? Like, what, mm-hmm, you know, what a witness, but it did happen really fast.
It's people very, were, I mean, really, the dispatch records show, like, between the time the Rhino gets in his car and when they call in that he's dead, it's like 80 seconds or something like that. It's like
pretty
a minute
fast.
And 20 seconds or right, something like that. So it's just very fast.
I'll honestly never get over this windshield thing. It is so insane to me. Now, was there anything else in there that I'm trying to think, but you guys probably have a better, was there anything else in that recent, those documents you got that you, it sticks out?
I mean, it's mostly things we talked about. I mean, you know, I think we were left with more questions about why law enforcement was kind of quick to say that Rynell fired when it was just based on really a single witness at the time. And also, you know, there's like a PowerPoint presentation where the investigators, Thurston County, had presented their findings. It's like an 80-page, you know, PowerPoint. And they had all the agency heads, because it's a task force, as Ryan had said. You know, you have different sheriff's departments and police departments kind of all coming together. And so all the leaders of those organizations kind of got in a room, and they were briefed on, you know, the day before the investigative file came out. And, you know, you see the photo of the Ford Escape, I think is what it is, with the bullet holes in it. I have to imagine, but there's no like text, like, you know, the officers, I mean, the way that it's presented, at least publicly, it really required, you know, journalists to go through and read and like understand, like, oh my gosh, like they have radio problems. They, you know, this guy's shooting through his front windshield, as you said. Like, these were not findings that were just laid out there for, you know, by law enforcement for the public. And I think that, you know, that troubled me for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, it was sort of, you had to go through the documents and read everything, and then you could ask a question of, you know, if the, you know, and it just really, it struck me as, I don't know, not the most upfront way to release something like this.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah. One other thing that, you know, stuck out to me when I was like going back over this today was, you know, some of the officer's statements when they're prepping to go on this operation is, you know, they're saying, we know he's Antifa, we know Antifa's violent, they're responsible for all the riots in Portland and Seattle, like, we know this is going to be dangerous. Like, their mindset going in was, this guy, I mean, first of all, there's like the whole Antifa thing, which is like, right, you know, sort of this culture that was playing out at the time with the president talking about this and stuff like that. But just like going in with this mindset of like, he's like a super dangerous guy. We have to, and you know, they had reason to believe he had killed somebody, but you know, I have to assume that in a law enforcement situation, your first objective is not to be like, we should engage in gunfire with people, you know?
Right. You know, being that Trump was so involved himself so much into this going forward, a lot of people, when it was unraveling, a lot of people, when the shooting happened, were calling this, you know, basically an execution, or which I think you could argue, regardless of Trump's involvement, the way that it all went down, what we know now, it could certainly be described that way. But also it was being, you know, described as like a hit or an assassination because of how and Trump was taking credit after all this, in terms of like he almost was hinting at the fact as if like he somehow let the U.S. Marshals know that it had to, you know, he had to face the most, you know, toughest of justices, which would be, you know, obviously his death. Is this case closed at this point? Like, do we have, like, is there any more, internal investigations to what went down? Will there ever be more that comes out? Or maybe there will be more that comes out, but is there any active look into what happened? Or is this pretty much everything we got now is all that's going to be, at least for now?
Go ahead, Conrad.
I mean, I the words execution, as you said, like those are, I think that's, I wouldn't go that far. I mean, I feel like the facts sort of speak for what the facts say based on the investigative file. It is unlike any statement I have ever read, the one Bill Barr, the attorney general at the time, put out the day after the shooting. I mean, it was celebratory, provocative. I heard from people who work in the Justice Department that were very troubled by the way it wasn't like conciliatory at all. It was really a provocative thing to say. And yes, as you pointed out afterwards, I mean, you know, Trump brought this up at, I remember a couple of days after, Trump was in North Carolina talking about it. I mean, became part of like a re-election stump speech for a while.
Yep.
And I mean, it's a person's life. I mean, and there, regardless of what someone's done, there is humanity there, right? I mean, and I've never, that was the most wild thing. And if anything, it really breathed into it, an element of questioning, you know, about like what really did happen. I think it, if this investigative file is the facts, right, and you know there isn't anything more, I mean, it certainly makes it almost a tougher job for these officers to kind of not have some scrutiny around the, you know, the way they handled the situation because of the president's remarks and because of what, you know, the leaders in the attorney general at the time was saying.
Right. Ryan Haas and Conrad Wilson of Oregon Public Broadcasting, thank you so much for joining me tonight. This was, the reporting on this has been incredible, but just laying this all out in, you know, pretty much so everyone has a full understanding of what went on. Because like you said earlier, I forget if it was you, Ryan, or Conrad, but one of you said earlier how, you know, a lot of this came out right away and people, you know, sort of read what came out and that was that. They felt case closed. They heard, you know, both people involved in the confrontation were killed and that's that. They missed everything that happened after, which includes everything you just told us right now. And of course, the most bizarre thing, this windshield shooting, I can't get over. So, putting this all together, I think really will help people. I don't know if they'll understand it, but at least be able to know exactly what went down. Because there isn't no way to understand this. This whole thing from Danielson's, Danielson's death to Reinhold's death, it all seems like it was all for such stupid reasons altogether, like just unnecessary deaths on both ends there.
Well, Matt, you had asked like, what are the, you know, I know you're wrapping up here, but like you had asked, what are the next steps? I mean, the case, the prosecuting attorney in the county has the case, you know, and they're kind of reviewing it for any potential criminal charges. I mean, that's
they're still looking. I assumed that, you know, when it would be.
No, it's still an open case from that regard. And the, you know, Reinhold's family has an attorney, two attorneys, I guess, in Washington State. And, you know, they haven't seen much of the, we all kind of saw the investigative file at the same time, but, they're looking at, you know, is there a potential civil litigation too that could come out of this?
Right. Right. And those two kids, like, yeah, think about that. It's just horrible, yeah. Horrible, really, really, a horrible story. But you know, I really appreciate the work you guys have done on this. And, why don't you each take the time to tell people where they could find your work, you know, any sort of Twitter profiles, upcoming stuff you want to promote, please feel free.
Sure. You can follow me on Twitter at Ryan J. Hass, all one word. And yeah, I mean, that's where all my work tends to go anyway. So yeah. Or opb.org, which is our website that we work for.
Yeah, I'm a Conrad J. Wilson on Twitter. And yeah, if this is reporting that has been valuable to you, you can go to opb.org and actually you can contribute if that's something that you feel compelled to do.
Thank you two so much. Also, I should thank you guys for downloading Skype and helping set that all up. Man, we had some tech issues earlier, and the Skype for Business is very different from regular Skype. So yeah. We had to quickly work this all out. So thank you guys so much. Yeah.
Yeah. For sure.
No, yeah. No wonder.
Thanks for having us.
No wonder Skype isn't beating Zoom and all those other video conferencing softwares. All right, guys. Have a great night. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
Take
Matt.
Care.
Talk to you later. Thank you.
Bye. Have a good one, Matt.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. Bloop, bloop. That was really, really incredible. When I was reading through that stuff, those pieces, and especially that latest, like the revelation of the windshield. I still can't. I mean, think about how much of what went down because of that one cop who shot through his windshield. That seems to be, I think, wrong. I know it's just what we could speculate, just our opinions. But I think Ryan is right. Everything that came out, all the misinformation, the eyewitness information, the fact that the other cops started shooting too, and we got 40 rounds out of it. It really does seem like this all went down because of that one cop who shot through his windshield. And in my opinion, I mean, I think there should be more of an investigation into him specifically. Why did he do that? Incredible story. And I hope Reinald's family, especially those two kids, I remember reading, seeing pictures, I mean, just really, really. And then there was, I didn't even bring this up but there was that video that came out after that someone took of Reinald on the floor in his last moments. He was looked, it was far away, but you could tell it looked really bad. And the cops didn't seem to really, they were like doing compressions on him, but they didn't even lay him down flat. I don't know the medical information there, so I can't, but it looked very weird, very bizarre, not anything I've ever seen before. And I do not, not going to tell any of you to go see that video because it's very disturbing. Even though he's far away and you can't really see much, it still is enough to really, you know, affect you. Folks, we're going to go to the second half of the show now. There is a lot more to talk about. I'm going to take calls, read super chats, read some YouTube comments. If you want to call into the show during the quick break in between, I am going to, and you can stick around if you're watching live. No need to leave, even if you're not a paying subscriber. Live stream viewers can stick around. Nothing will change. It'll be on this feed. I'm just going to take a quick break in a minute. But you can drop a super chat right here in the YouTube chat, and I will be sure to read your super chats. Those are guaranteed. They could be questions, comments, whatever you like. I will read it if it's a super chat, for sure. I'll try to get in some other YouTube chats as I see them come in. You can call into the show. I will open it up during that break. Doomed Live on Skype. I promise you, I said it before, but I'm working on like a Discord audio chat and other ways to call into the show, but right now it's still Skype. You'll be able to Skype Doomed Live. Just search it when you open up Skype. You'll see it. I'll take your calls. What else? Most importantly, if you have the ability to do so, patreon.com/mattbinder to monetarily support this show. Lost a few patrons this past week, one for a very sad reason I'm going to bring up in a minute. You know, this is, people are still struggling, it seems, with everything going on with the pandemic and all. So if you are fine, again, if you are having financial, please take care of yourself and your family first. But if you can afford to support this show, patreon.com/MattBinder. I really appreciate it. You'll get an invite to the Discord. We're going to do, we're probably gonna do it next week. I'll let you know for sure. The first, only patron chat. We're going to do like a Zoom type thing. I'll let you guys know more information on the Patreon page. So now's your chance to get in on that. New patrons from the last show. I can't remember if I shouted out this person. So Melbo, thanks for joining. And John R, thank you for John L, I should say, his middle initials are. So John R L, thank you so much for becoming a patron. Really appreciate your support. And like I said before, lost a few patrons this week, but one, you know, I didn't message the family or anything, but I want to do this because I looked into this person and I can't believe how long they supported this show. So I got this sad news this past week that. Well, first, I got a cancellation notification on Patreon, and, you know, I usually check to make sure, see why the person left, because I wanted to make sure, you know, usually due to financial issues, and I always feel bad about that and want to let them know that, you know, anything that, you know, if you want that member's audio, please, I'll be happy to give it to you. I looked to see why this person canceled, and unfortunately, a member of the show passed away due to cancer. And this is a really early member, Nicole A. She had been one of the first patrons of the show. She was one of the longest patrons of this from back in 2018 when I first launched the Patreon page. And, you know, I didn't really put much into it then, but she wanted to support like I do now, but she wanted to support even then. And then I got the message. They said that their family member contacted me and said, Nicole passed away from cancer, but she loved you folks. The reason I'm doing this right now is I want to take a moment and just thank this person for supporting the show. By the sound of it, loved you folks. She was a supporter of, I'm assuming, some other adjacent shows to mine. Maybe a Majority Report or other shows. Michael Brooks, I don't know. Or maybe, I don't know. But that's just my guess from how I read that. I feel like, you know, this person, obviously, progressive values, good person. I just wanted to shout her out, that's all, and say, you know, rest in peace. MW says, wait a sec, was she a mod? No, I don't think she was a mod. Was she an MR mod? I don't know. But yeah, anyone who's been, you know, patron or not even patron, just a listener of anything I do. And back in the Majority Report, I remember there was some, you know, over the years at the Majority, I've been doing this for a decade now since I joined the Majority Report. And over the years, there have been a few people that have passed away and very sad. And Sam usually made a mention of them to thank them for the support. And this is the first time this has happened to me directly in terms of someone supporting this show. And, you know, it actually, I did, you know, take a moment and I felt sad. I honestly don't care about the money. It's really not, just in case anyone's, one person complained about me promoting the Patreon page too much. And I was like, I probably promote it less than anyone, you know, who has a Patreon. I barely ever say anything other than the end of the show. I barely ever mention it. Look at my Twitter. I never promoted it at all. It was But like, you know, so I just, I don't know what that person was thinking, but life is too short. You know, everyone take care of yourself. What else? You could also go to, ratethispodcast.com/doomed to leave ratethispodcast.com/doomed. Go there and you'll get links to everywhere you can leave a podcast review. When you do that, you help this show grow by promoting it up in the podcast rankings. You know, you go to Apple Podcasts, I'm not going to say leave a 5-star review. Leave the number of stars you think this show is worthy of. I'll appreciate 5. And leave a written review too if you can. Written reviews are a big help too. It lets people see that there are actual people behind those reviews. So if you do that, that'd be great. Just got a notification. I always try to do this. If you join during the show, I try to thank you out. Thank you. Darian joined the Patreon. Tim D. Just edited their pledge up. Thank you, Tim. And a new patron, Amanda B. Thank you so much for supporting the show. Really appreciate it. The show has been, like I say all the time, it has been an upward trajectory. Until this month, actually. This month we sort of plateaued for a little bit. But maybe this will be the turnaround. Thank you, Darian, Tim, and Amanda. How else can you support this show without spending money? Tell your friends, your family, whoever you think would like this show, tell them about it. Tell your favorite podcasters, YouTubers, Twitch streamers, that you want to see me on their show and them on this show. I'm actually going to start a post, put up a post on the Patreon page for patrons first, then I'll open up to everybody. But I want some suggestions. I know people send it to me during the show, but I want some written suggestions, easy for me to keep track of it. I'll post that on the Patreon page if you're a patron, and then I'll open it up to everybody later on. We're going to go to the second half of the show now. Give me, excuse me, a quick second to take care of this cough. I was actually got sick this past weekend. I got like a 24-hour bug, but the cough stayed with me. What else did I want to say? Oh, before we go, though, did you guys, I'll talk about it more in the second half, but I just wanted to mention in the first half for everybody to hear. Did you guys see that Halsey, big music artist Halsey, 14 million followers on Twitter, has played super big shows, was on SNL, I think, more than once as a musical guest, and she shared Michael Brooks's amazing speech on... the situation in the Middle East, obviously not what's going on right now, but Michael's speech is clearly evergreen, unfortunately, when it comes to this. And she shared it. And it wasn't just like a retweet of some... It wasn't just like a retweet of somebody else or just like she clicked the share button somewhere and... She, like, took the time to, like, title it It's Not Complicated by Michael Brooks, which it's the video is not called that. So she watched it and took that line out of it. And she shared it. I mean, I know people said, oh, no, Halsey. I saw people saying, like, oh, no, Halsey, she's got good politics. She's a Bernie supporter. I mean, Bernie Sanders was a presidential candidate. I mean, there's a lot of people who know Bernie Sanders. And a lot of people who probably supported him. Doesn't mean they know who our little bubble. Doesn't mean they know our world. I mean, tens of millions of people in the primaries voted for Bernie Sanders. between 2016 and 2020. Hundreds of millions, if not more, all over the world know Bernie Sanders' name. Then people forget what a little like bubble we live in, like the leftist news files. Like, really, that's who the audience is here. I wish we were more mainstream. I think Michael especially deserves to be more mainstream. I hope he gets that that now in passing, but unfortunately in passing, but yeah, I hope that legacy lives on there. But I mean, to come across that from someone of that, that's a big deal. Like, it's not like I was very emotional when I saw that, to be quite honest, to see him getting his work getting promoted that way. I'm going to play a clip of it in the second half of the show. And I got more to say about that whole, what's going on this week? Just horrible, horrible. What's going on? Horrible. I mean, if you can't stand up for the Palestinian people after this week and see what the Israeli government's doing to those people, I mean, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to say. You can have whatever your opinion is on Israel. We'll talk more about that later. But if your basis isn't, you know, at the very least, I support Israel, but what's going on is not right, and it's a crime against humanity. I don't know what else to say. I mean, we're crossing over to some really horrible stuff, and I'm afraid it's gonna get worse. I mean, it's bad right now as we speak. All right, folks. Didn't mean to end it on that note, but I had to get some words in the free half before we go to the second half of the show. All right, thank you for tuning in. Stick around if you're watching the live stream or if you're a patron. Jeez, I'll get something for this cough. Everybody else, see you all next time on Doomed.